Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a subject that I've really been wanting to talk about for a long time, and we've located a very capable individual to share his perspective on this vital subject. You know, we talk about vitamins and minerals and supplements and diet, and we talk about high-tech medicine, but too often we give short shrift to a very important part of the health equation, which is exercise. We're going to talk to a physician, a medical doctor, who incorporates exercise into his practice. Also, he is a poster boy for the principle that exercise can keep you fit. And he has a very interesting background. He is Dr. DeWade Perry. Grew up in Ohio. Pursued medical studies after a stint in the United States Marine Corps, where obviously he underwent intense physical training, and then ultimately opened up a practice in Oregon, located in Eugene, Oregon. He has been a competitor in sports for most of his life. I know that he is a very dedicated bodybuilder. Also, he enjoys an unusual distinction because he is a medical doctor, but he is also a certified personal trainer, credential that was awarded by the American Council on Exercise, and he is an expert in various styles of martial arts as well. He works with all kinds of patients out there in Oregon, but in particular works with patients who are trying to get physically fit, and many individuals in the martial arts field. So without further ado, here's Dr. DeWade Perry. Dr. Perry, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's great to be with you and with your listeners. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, thank you. I hope I covered it all, but you have a very interesting background because you come to the field of medicine probably as a dedicated athlete and as a former United States Marine, which ain't easy, and you maintained... apparently, you dedicated your life to maintaining a high level of fitness. Tell us a little bit about how you got to the point where you are in medicine.
Well, I had always wanted to become a surgeon ever since I was a child, so that part of it was in my head. But indeed, I was involved in sports from my childhood. That was bestowed upon me by my father. I was in martial arts as a child. Played football, things like that. But then when I got to college, my college did not have a football team, so I played collegiate tennis. That's when I joined the Marine Corps and continued my physical pursuits at that time. After the
I guess so. When they sent you to the Persian Gulf War, it wasn't just to play tennis.
Indeed, it was not.
I mean, it was temperatures were warm, but I'm not sure there were that many tennis courts out there.
No, not at all. Not one bit. So in medical school, I was able to do some training, some physical training, but not as much as I would like. At that time, I started focusing more on martial arts. And then residency started, and as you mentioned, I was a general surgery resident. And during that time, it was kind of interesting because whenever we completed rounds on patients, while my colleagues went to do whatever they did, whether they hung out at the local restaurant or what have you, or went to read, I actually went to the gym. So every night I was not on call, I was actually at the gym. There were some times where I actually fell asleep sitting on a bench between sets in the gym.
Yeah, I can imagine, because a surgical residency, you know, especially, you know, maybe now it's very arduous, but a few years back, a couple of decades ago, a very, very arduous program of maybe, you know, not getting any sleep perhaps every second or third night.
That's correct. I did my training prior to the reduction to 80 hours.
So right, reduction 80 hours, folks. Remember, this is medical interns and residents catching a break. They're restricting their hours to 80 hours. And so often, you know, because of the machismo of medicine, they violate that rule left and right because, you know, we don't want to be a wuss and just work 80 hours a week. That wouldn't be adequate to become a machismo doctor.
That's right. That's very correct. And so I continued my training during residency, and then following in my last year of residency, I decided to try a competition in bodybuilding, and that was 2002. And so I started bodybuilding in 2002, and then resumed my intensive martial art training in 2004. And so that's sort of my journey. And I did general surgery as a career from 2002 to 2007. And then in 2007, I transitioned to my current practice, which is what you mentioned in the introduction.
Because, obviously you could have been a great surgeon, but you felt that you had a different perspective on health, more towards lifestyle modification, diet, the use of nutritional supplements, some of the same things that we share in common. I, do these things in my practice, too.
That's right. The thing was, I was already doing everything I do in my practice and my personal life while a surgeon, but there was no way to combine the both of them in a career. And so I decided to focus all of my energies on at what I call advanced preventative medicine or performance medicine and leave surgery behind.
Right. And, your personal experience led you to believe that exercise was beneficial. It was a great stress buster. It kept you in good condition while the rest of your colleagues, whittled away their time in bars or became, fat around the midsection because of sleep deprivation and lack of exercise. But obviously you've made a study of how exercise can be beneficial for our health. I mean, it's a truism. We know exercise is good for you, but let's look at some of the specific physiologic benefits of exercise as you see patients in your practice.
Sure. I think the key thing that I try to emphasize with patients in terms of exercise is strength training. A lot of patients are familiar with doing some sort of aerobic type training, whether it's walking or getting on a treadmill. And that's typically what you'll see when one goes to, any of the commercial gyms or what have you. Lots of people will get on the aerobic equipment. But not too many people delve into the other side of the gym, where the dumbbells and the barbells are. And so I really try to emphasize the need to incorporate strength training into one's exercise program.
Well, that's interesting. As you say, a lot of people think that putting on some sneakers and taking a run or getting on the Stairmaster or the elliptical that constitutes a workout, and they often give short shrift to strength training. Some people think that strength training, though, is for narcissistic meatheads, muscleheads, people who are just trying to look awesome, and that they're really no benefits.
Right, exactly. However, there are a multitude of benefits, some of which include it's the best way, that is, strength training is the best way to increase one's bone strength. It also increases one's sensitivity to insulin. So when you exercise with strength training, your body responds to insulin better. And it can increase your quote-unquote good cholesterol, your HDL. It increases flexibility and balance, and it improves body composition. So there's much more to resistance training than simply looking good, if you will.
Right. I mean, it doesn't hurt to look good. But, there's this process that they say is inevitable, which is the loss of muscle and the accumulation of fat. They sometimes refer to this as sarcopenia. Maybe you can give us a definition.
Indeed. Yeah, sarcopenia is basically the loss of muscle mass as one ages, particularly after the age of 25. The generally quoted statistic is about 0.5% to 1% of muscle loss occurs after the age of 25.
Per year. Per year, right?
Per year, that's correct, yes.
Right, okay. So imagine over the course of 30, 40, 50 years, there's not going to be much left.
That's right. What's interesting, though, is that studies will tell you that the more muscle a person achieves, or more muscle mass he or she achieves before the onset of sarcopenia or before the age of 25, the less one loses after the age of 25. So it's important for adolescents and young adults to engage in some sort of strength training, because the more you have prior to sarcopenia beginning, the more muscle mass you can retain.
Right. It's like a reserve against future losses.
Exactly.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, unlike you, I guess I missed the boat in that respect because I was not balanced like you, both academically and in the physical realm. I was a real egghead, didn't do a lot of physical exercise in high school, began to discover exercise only in college, became a runner and aerobic exercise. It was only in, you know, sort of my 30s, 40s that I began to start doing more strength training. Fortunately, it wasn't too late to forestall complete deterioration.
That's good though. That's great though, because it's, you know, one adage that's very true is that it's never too late to start.
Good, and I think that's we want to impart that message to our listeners, because and actually some studies show that even patients who are lying abed with congestive heart failure can squeeze a soft rubber ball and actually regain muscle strength, and that may ultimately even help their heart's pumping action.
Exactly. There's a systemic effect to even isolated limb training and with resistance exercise. So, yeah, even a small amount of resistance training can benefit a patient.
Is there a balance or a formula that you recommend for your patient? I mean, it's like a certain ratio of, you know, some aerobic to some strength.
Not necessarily. I think it really depends on the individual person, where they are in terms of their exercise journey. And are they just beginning? Are they more intermediate, more advanced type? And what are their goals? So all of that goes into, if you will, a formula to determine how much resistance training to do versus how much aerobic or anaerobic training to do. So there's no one-size-fits-all when looking at that sort of thing. It is very important, though, to include both, obviously.
Well, you mentioned the word anaerobic. You know, we hear aerobic, we hear anaerobic. There's a new term that's popular in the exercise field, which is high-intensity interval training. I presume you're familiar with that term. Can you share your understanding of that with our listeners?
Well, high-intensity interval training is simply a style of aerobic conditioning or anaerobic conditioning, depending on how hard you do the exercise, where one will alternate a period of intense work with a period of rest. So, for instance, one can sprint on a football field for 10 seconds and then walk for 20 seconds and alternate those periods of work and rest for a predetermined amount of repetitions.
In high school, we used to call those suicides, I think.
Exactly. Suicides, exactly. We call the same thing in football. But one can also vary the time of the sprint and work phases, or of the work and recovery phases. For instance, the Tabata protocol, which is a type of high-intensity interval training, incorporates inverse ratio of work to rest. So in Tabata training, one will work for 20 seconds and rest for only 10. That's a very very difficult work-rest ratio, but that just gives one an idea of the type of things you can do with high interval training. And you can do that sort of training in a pool. You can do it on a track, on stairs, anywhere where you can sprint and recover is called high intensity interval training.
You're trained as a personal trainer, so I think one of the hallmarks of that, by the way, that's a credential that I would love to get. That's been on my agenda for a long time. And, I really would like to, before I, end my medical career, I would like to acquire an additional credential as an expert in, training people how to properly exercise.
Because
I think that could be of huge benefit in offering consultations. Because right now I know how to tell people to take vitamins, how to properly prepare and cook food. I do that on my own, but I would like to be able to impart that information to my patients. I think that gives you a great advantage. So you work with patients of all kinds of proficiencies. You work with, I'm sure, amateur and even perhaps professional athletes, as well as individuals with you know, who are weak, tired, you know, having disabilities, long-term sedentary people. You're able to customize their programs.
Exactly, because obviously, first and foremost, I am a physician, so I can, you know, approach different issues from a medical perspective as well as a personal trainer perspective. So the two go hand in hand in my book, and that's the main reason why I do what I do, because I can help patients in both arenas, in medicine and in terms of helping them with a great exercise program that can get them up and going.
Well, share with us, you know, I know it's going to be exhausting for many of us to listen to this, but share with us your own personal exercise regimen. If you don't mind sharing, how old are you now?
I'm now 44.
44. So, you know, you're in your prime, but there are a lot of 44-year-olds who are sitting around, you know, watching too much football and not participating in enough sports. So what do you do? What is your regimen like?
Well, my regimen, 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I do my traditional bodybuilding or resistance training. That lasts anywhere from an hour and a half on Mondays and Wednesdays to 2 hours on Friday. And then after that, I immediately go to one of my martial arts schools where I practice Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is a style of martial art that focuses on ground fighting, so fighting on the ground. That's Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I do my second type of martial art called Muay Thai or Thai boxing. That's a striking martial art where you kick, punch, and knees and elbows. That's on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then on Saturday, I take a day off. And on Sundays, I do my own version of CrossFit, or where I incorporate some weight training, or I might do sprinting, or I might do rowing, or rope climbing, or any sort of you know, combination of different exercises to tax my anaerobic system, my muscle system, and my aerobic system.
Yeah,
I train 6 days a week, and I take Saturdays off.
Okay, good, because on the seventh day, even the Lord rested, so you need to take
a little break.
And rest, I mean, let's face it, I mean, rest to a greater or lesser extent is important for virtually any athlete. Some people require, you know, you got to know your body, but some people require more time for rest and repair. Usually the older you are, the more you need recovery cycles. If you're younger, you can withstand longer bouts of intensive exercise without off days. But you know that there's a whole consolidation phase when, you know, your body does repair and rest.
That's correct. I also find, however, that nutrition plays a large role in recovery. Even though it may take older athletes a little longer to recover than some of their younger counterparts, if one has very good nutrition, optimal nutrition, then that gap between recovery between an older athlete and younger athlete is much, much smaller, almost negligible, depending on the two athletes involved. So I think that nutrition and then getting into supplementation can really help the older athlete to recover and be almost as recovered as a much younger athlete can.
Well, I would like to think that I am personally conducting a science fair project of that type on my own 61-year-old body, because I hope to continue to compete in triathlons. That's sort of the test, you know, in the summer season. I try to see how I compare to my times when I was in my 30s. And fortunately, you know, still holding up. And I agree, nutrition plays an important role. What nutrition tips do you give to your athletes? And I know that it different strokes for different folks, different stages of life, different you know, ages or conditioning states. But what are some of the important guidelines?
Well, indeed, it does depend on what type of athlete or patient, if you will, the individual is. But in general, I tell the patient to focus on vegetables. so I'm not a vegetarian at all, but I like the patient or the athlete to focus on getting a large amount, unlimited amount of especially green leafy vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
I like them to start there. And then I like them to get a good, healthy serving of lean protein, whether it's red meat, organic and grass-fed and grass-finished red meat, or if it's poultry or fish. And then I like them to get a good serving, a good healthy serving of healthy fats, mostly omega-3, but I also include some good monounsaturated fats like avocados or olive oil, quality olive oil. Or sometimes I actually use high oleic sunflower or safflower oil, not regular sunflower mm-hmm. or safflower, but high oleic.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that there was actually a form of those oils available that's high oleic, because you know you don't want to get all those omega-6 oils into your system, but I guess that may
exactly.
counteract some of the adverse effects of highly refined sunflower or safflower oil.
Totally those oils, the high oleic will specifically say on the label high oleic.
Okay.
So those would I recommend. And then finally, quality carbohydrates. Mostly what I focus on would be perhaps sweet potatoes, berries, of course, some other fruits. And I am not actually opposed to grains. I know there's a controversy, obviously, on what's on grain eating, but I'm not opposed to some grains.
Mm-hmm.
So so for some patients and some athletes, I will incorporate grains too.
Right. And there are some athletes who just swear by the gluten-free approach, but it doesn't work for everyone. Was the tennis player Djokovic
who
I guess he lost at the U.S. Open, but nonetheless, he claims enormous benefits, and some people do in terms of energy when they get off gluten because they have an intolerance. That doesn't necessarily mean that they shouldn't have any carbs. It sounds like you're advocating a relatively low-carb diet, because in the past what they've recommended is lots of carbo-loading, you know, big heaping platters of pasta before a marathon, and then sugary drinks, you know, Gatorade and, you know, that kind of thing to enhance performance. You're not a big believer in those things?
No, and I've never been, because my background has been through bodybuilding. My coming into nutrition for the most part was through bodybuilding, and I say this all the time, but bodybuilders have always been at the forefront of nutrition and supplementation,
mm-hmm.
Ahead of medicine.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because you tend to think of bodybuilders as, you know, kind of lunkheads. I mean, frankly, right? I mean, that's the image that you're bucking here.
Right. That's the image, but nothing can be further from the truth. For the most part, bodybuilders have always pushed the envelope. It's an extreme sport, obviously, to strip body fat to its lowest, you know, possible levels while maintaining as much muscle mass as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So bodybuilders have always pushed the envelope in terms of nutrition and supplementation. So my approach is usually approximately 40% protein, 30% fats and 30% carbohydrates. That's
mm-hmm.
my usual approach, and then I tailor the macronutrient percentages from there depending on the patient or the athlete's goals.
Right. And there's actually whole sort of cycling regimes that are used for bodybuilders so that they can get the, you know, literally the veins popping out, you know, at the competitions.
Right.
You know, with,
indeed. Indeed.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah, with like ultra low body fat, great
right.
Lean to fat percentage is the goal, body sculpting and so on. All right, so when it comes to patients who have specific problems, let's take a look at a, you know, fairly typical woman in my practice who might be 50 or 60, you know, not a big exerciser, you know, they've been there, done that, they've dabbled with exercise, but now they're confronted with what is virtually a universal problem, osteopenia or osteoporosis, and they're desirous of a program that will enhance their bone density without using drugs. Does exercise offer a plausible alternative here?
Exercise does offer a plausible alternative. However, it needs to be the right exercise.
Right. So
right,
some people will say, okay, I just do this. Some people say, well, I walk a lot. Is that going to do the trick?
I will say to that woman, yes, it will do the trick if you're wearing a backpack with weight in it.
Okay.
But just walking by itself, no, walking by itself will not do much to improve your bone density. So, so that's the answer to that. If you wear a backpack with weight, then that will help, but not just walking on its own.
Right. So you need to put a little extra added stress besides the stress of ordinary gravity on your bones. And there are some sports which are great sports, like swimming, for example, and cycling, which I do a lot of, but they don't seem to do a heck of a lot for bone density, do they?
That's very true, Dr. Hall, but they do not. Neither swimming nor cycling will increase bone density or bone mass,
okay,
unfortunately. So I know a lot of older individuals, or individuals in general, but in particular, a lot of older individuals, because there's less stress on their joints, they prefer to do some swimming or cycling, but unfortunately, those two exercises have not been shown to increase bone mass.
Okay. What about patients who have, and this is, you probably see this in your practice as well out there on the West Coast, although you're a little bit inland, you're not quite on the coast, is a chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, these people are exhausted and tired all the time. Can exercise of the right kind play a role in restoring their energy and vitality?
It certainly can. I recall meeting a patient, actually she was a friend. This was while I was a young resident. So this was the mid-90s. And this woman had been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And I remember her saying to me that she had been told by her physicians to not exercise.
To refrain
to avoid
from
exercise.
Right.
Right. But now we know that, indeed, the correct exercise program can help these individuals. So it is very important for patients with chronic fatigue or other sort of fatigue syndromes to get involved in some sort of exercise program.
Right, and that might be, you know, very gentle, graded exercise with interspersed with periods of rest,
exactly,
to sort of recondition the autonomic nervous system to be accustomed to bouts of exertion, and then taking down the sympathetic tone to get into a relaxation state.
Right, exactly. And I should mention, while walking and bicycling or swimming may not be the best, there are other exercises that will help improve osteopenia and osteoporosis, and those, as you mentioned, will be more weight-bearing exercise. So certainly resistance training, jogging is actually one that can help, hiking, doing plyometric exercises, or even climbing stairs. All of those work against gravity, and so those can help increase the strength of the bones.
Okay, so another common condition is arthritis. You know, people, they get older, they have aches and pains, their knees and hips, and often they get that same advice. Refrain from exercise because all that wear and tear is just going to grind your hips and knee, the synovial membrane down, and you'll wear them out. But I think, you know, you've probably been keeping an eye on the literature, scientific studies, and scientific studies are now saying that, you know, not punishing ultramarathons, perhaps, but, you know, moderate exercise, even running, can be performed by people with arthritis, and it keeps them flexible.
There's no doubt about that at all. Osteoarthritis in particular responds very well to strength training, particularly the knees and other joints. So, that old advice for patients with arthritis to avoid exercise or strength training is exactly that, old advice. So the new paradigm is to go ahead and incorporate strength training in their exercise program to strengthen their muscles, and which will strengthen their bones and help alleviate some of the pain and discomfort from osteoarthritis and other arthritic syndromes.
You know, one phenomenon that I have some mixed feelings about is, I don't know about out by you in Oregon, but here in New York, what's all the rage among 20-somethings and 30-somethings and sometimes beyond is cross-training, you know, really extreme exercise. I mean, you engage in it, so you're very familiar with it, but for some, it's a fantastic tune-up. You can lose 20, 30 pounds, become extremely fit. For others, it's a fast track to the sports medicine doctor's office or the chiropractor's office with injuries. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you're referring to CrossFit.
CrossFit, excuse me, not cross-training.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Of course. Yeah,
right,
CrossFit.
Yeah. You're Exactly. You're referring to CrossFit. And indeed, CrossFit is very controversial. But my take on CrossFit is this. I think CrossFit has a role in helping certain individuals achieve certain states of physical fitness. The issue is, one, is the instructor or the instructors, are they qualified enough to instruct the particular exercises that are typically done in a CrossFit setting? Most CrossFit facilities incorporate what are called Olympic lifts. Olympic lifts are the two lifts that are done in the Olympics. They're called the snatch and the clean and jerk.
Right, right.
Those two lifts involve very technical movements. And so the question is, are the clients at these gyms receiving the proper instruction to do those lifts? That's number one. Number two is the concept of CrossFit is to do as much as you can in a certain amount of time. Obviously, when you're doing when you're trying to lift weights fast in a certain amount of time, one's technique can deteriorate as one fatigues. Obviously,
right.
That sets up the chance for injury.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the two main issues that I have with CrossFit, is doing Olympic lifts and other explosive movements, repetition after repetition for time, which, in my opinion, increases the risk of injury. And secondly, are these individuals receiving the proper instruction for some of these more technical lifts and technical movements that are incorporated in CrossFit?
Yeah, my take is that it has to be very individualized. You have to work into it, and you have to take into account, you know, your age, your conditioning status, previous injuries, and be prudent, and don't, you know, don't throw yourself into it. Because I have to say, I don't know about people out by you, but the average New Yorker is super competitive and aggressive, and sometimes it's a little bit mind over matter, and the no pain, no gain principle doesn't take you very far with certain types of exercise.
Right, that's very true. I've lived in other places in the U.S., of course, through training and medicine and that type of thing, but I don't get the sense that most people here are competitive to the point of New York. But I will say this also about CrossFit is that another thing is for the person to not focus on the other athletes or the other clients in the gym. I think that's another key point, that people try to outdo the other clients.
Right, right.
But if they focus on themselves, that also can decrease their risk of injury because they're not pushing as hard. So I think that's a key point also. But
yeah, I want to take advantage of your expertise because, you know, as we booked this interview, this controversy had kind of receded to the background, but it's suddenly been propelled into the forefront with the amazing interview, perhaps you saw it, on CBS with Chris Bosch. That has rekindled the A-Rod controversy, and now his year-long suspension, his protestations that he's not guilty of anything, he's going to take it to federal court. And this is really highlighting the issue of performance-enhancing drugs among athletes. And,
right.
You know, I want you to step away a little bit from the, you know, the moral considerations and the legal considerations here, because, you know, there's a controversy as to, do we want our athletes to be role models? Is it fair to use performance enhancing drugs? My take on this is that, that there may be some advantages to certain, performance enhancing drugs like testosterone for the general populace, say an aging individual who has trouble walking or, you know, has trouble with healing injuries, that this whole controversy is obscuring because it's a question of, is it legal, is it not legal, it's bad for you, it's good for you. Is there some sort of nuance that we're missing because of the lurid press coverage?
That's certainly the case. Obviously, we know, meaning you and I and other physicians know, that certain hormones tend to decrease as we get older. And if we replace those hormones, patients do much better. Their quality of life improves. Their mortality in certain studies show that the mortality decreases. And those hormones would be the sex hormones, like testosterone, and sometimes in some studies, growth hormone also. Testosterone, though, is quite important for men, and it a lot of benefits for men, not only improvements in sexual functioning, but improvements in mentation, improvements in strength, body composition, decreased fatigue, and those type of things. But when athletes, high-profile athletes, are caught, if you will, abusing or using these substances when they're prohibited, the general public tends to get a negative perception of these often life-saving hormones, which we all have and all need as men and women. So it definitely sort of gives a negative connotation to these hormones and to these medications that really, if used properly, have a great benefit in patients.
Yeah, and I would totally agree with you, is that they have to be used prudently under proper medical supervision. You know, I think that probably the least good candidates for lots and lots of testosterone are 26 or 31-year-old professional athletes. But certainly, you know, people as they age, you know, the physical conditioning is very important, and testosterone supports that. And also it supports, you know, muscle retention, which we know is good for the heart, it's good for diabetes, and so on. So, you know, too bad about the A-Rod story. But boy, I have to say, you know, listening to Chris Bosch, it sounds so complicated, it sounds so technical, you know, to get it, just, you know, the injections, the lozenges, all the different ways that he took these various compounds. It really sounds like rocket science.
Actually, it's not. And if one really listens to that interview and knows about testosterone, because that's what he talked about the most.
Yeah.
It's interesting because some of the things that were said medically just aren't true.
Yeah, something about, like, he said something about how, like, if you pee in a cup to get your testosterone check, you should
exactly.
When I heard that, I said, really? That's really interesting that the midstream urine doesn't reflect. I said, where does he get that stuff?
Exactly.
That really perked up my ears when I heard that interview. Yeah.
One of the most glaring errors that he said, and that was just one of them. But
it sounds like urban legend in the gyms where they use these kind of performance enhancing drugs. It's like a, you know, there's a whole subculture around this.
Right, exactly. But I sort of chuckled when I was listening to the interview because, again, in certain sports with which I'm familiar, very familiar, this is nothing new. This is all old hat. These techniques have been done for, you know, years and years. So for a lot of people, it may sound like it's, you know, cutting edge or new or very complicated, but it really isn't.
Yeah.
It really isn't complicated whatsoever. And it's not new at all either. So
it's just newly coming to light, and you know, we're moving the goalposts in various sports where things were tolerated. It's kind of like the same thing that's happened in Wall Street. It's like, oh, you know, inside trading, now that's bad. All of a sudden, now you can get a federal indictment for it. In the past, it was just like you know, finding out about things ahead of the curve. Similarly,
right.
Using these drugs in certainly in cycling, in many sports, football, this was de rigueur in the past. And, you know, if we want to clean the sport up, okay, fine. But let's just get clear on what we're looking to do.
Exactly.
But, you know, let's look at the other perspective. Do you have any words for, you know, some of the kids, you know, who are trying to get big? They want to compete, bodybuilding or wrestling, various sports. Maybe they want to, you know, become baseball pitchers, and, you know, they want to keep their arms strong. Do you have any advice to those young athletes? Should they sell their soul to the testosterone dealer?
This is what I say to young athletes. Number one, your testosterone levels are going to be as high as they will ever be during this time. So if you're in your, you know, late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, that type of thing, number one, your testosterone level is already high, so that's number one. Number two, you're going to get the most bang for your buck through nutrition and your training. The addition of testosterone or any other performance-enhancing drug is going to be, in my estimation, in the single digits.
No, or maybe it's like a rabbit's foot or a placebo, you know, that you're just using that to maybe give you more that that performance edge, the confidence that you need, but it's not going to really make substantial difference.
That's my opinion, exactly. So focus on nutrition, optimal nutrition, focus on training the best way you can, and then also realize that, in some instances, some supplements are very beneficial. Some over-the-counter proven supplements are very beneficial. And then thirdly, realize that if you do use testosterone, then you will suppress your body's own ability to make testosterone, and you may affect your ability to bear children have children in the future. So there's some real negative consequences to using hormones. So number one, your hormone levels are already high. Number two, focus on nutrition and training and some supplementation, and that will get you where you need to go.
Good. And what about those huge vats of protein that athletes consume? I look at the pictures of the muscle-bound athletes on the labels, and I look at these big vats. They're like 10, 15 pounds of protein. I figure, you know, maybe you could curl them and you'd get, you know, some muscle building.
Do you
subscribe to the notion that you need inordinate amounts of extra protein powder to build muscles?
Well, this is what I subscribe to. I subscribe to the notion that athletes, whether they are endurance athletes or strength athletes, need more protein than the RDA, which is typically 0.8 grams per kilo body weight.
Okay.
So the different numbers, the numbers vary.
So that'd be less than 100 grams of protein for the average person.
Exactly. So my first premise is that we need more protein than that. So if one can cook enough to obtain the necessary amount of protein, then I say use whole foods and cook your food, etc. But most of the athletes and most of the patients I have don't have time to cook enough to do that. So I do advise supplementation with a whey protein. That's my recommendation, mm-hmm, is to use a whey isolate.
Okay.
But I don't just say get any type of whey. It has to be, you know, I have preferences for the whey isolate that I use and recommend. So, but yes.
Now, you work a lot with MMA folks, you know, the mixed martial arts, which again is highly controversial. It's illegal in some states. And some people just think it's, unchained brutality. It's like, harkens back to, you know, the, bare-fisted fighting that, you know, we would have in the fight clubs and the alleyways, of, 19th century America. But you actually participate in this and you work with some of these athletes. Do you think that this can be done in a beneficial way without people getting severe concussions, brain damage, permanent injuries?
I definitely do. Well, there's a little history here. When mixed martial arts, that term, mixed martial arts began, it started with a certain promotion called Ultimate Fighting Championship, and that was in 1993. Previous to that, I'm sure there was some form of combat, such as mixed martial arts, but it wasn't official. But in 1993, the UFC started, and at that time, there were no weight classes. There were very few rules, and indeed, fights in those times were quite brutal and just ridiculous. But since then, there's been the institution of weight classes, rules, etc. And so now, the competition is no different, in my opinion, than any other physical sport. Yes, there's some bleeding from cuts or what have you, but again, it's no different than any other physical sport like rugby or football or even basketball or boxing.
Certainly boxing,
and if you look, yeah, exactly. And so if you look at the concussion rates and that type of thing, by doctors like Dr. Joseph Maroon in Pittsburgh or some of the doctors who implemented the impact system for the concussions. Mm-hmm.
By the way, Dr. Maroon has been a guest with me here on this program. So I'm familiar with it. He's done a lot of, he's a neurosurgeon at University yes. of Pittsburgh Medical Center, where he has actually worked out a concussion scale that now I think it's been adopted by the NFL and many, even college and high school athletic departments to assess whether kids and athletes can go back on the field after getting hit.
Exactly. And if you look at some of his data, one would be surprised at the sports that have high concussion rates, like soccer and some other sports. So MMA or mixed martial arts is actually a very safe sport, and I don't have any problems being involved with it or training in it or anything like that. It's quite different than what the what some people think of when they think about mixed martial arts. Very different from that.
Do you ever work with these individuals who've suffered concussions? Is there a rehab program or a comeback trail? Because there's a lot of people outside the field of sports who experience head injuries. Now there's returning vets, GIs who've had IED injuries. Anything in particular that seems to facilitate recovery from head injuries?
There are. I don't work specifically with concussion patients, but I do and peripherally work with those type of patients or athletes. But in general, what facilitates healing from concussions are things which you already know. One would be limiting the amount of brain excitability. So things like watching TV, using a computer, reading, things that stimulate the brain. One wants to definitely limit during the healing process. That's the current thinking.
So you get into a period of almost like enforced isolation or enforced relaxation.
Exactly. And then just repeat testing in terms of cognitive testing to ensure that the patient or the athlete is recovering. But the biggest is sort of brain rest, if you will. That's the biggest component of concussion management these days.
That's interesting. All right. Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you have evolved a very successful paradigm at the Center for Integrative Health and Performance, where you integrate diet, supplements, intravenous therapies, hormonal optimization with tailored exercise programs. You're out there in Eugene, Oregon. How can people get wind of what you're up to there?
Well, I do have a website, and if I can say the website,
please.
But I do have a website. It's Center for IHAP.com, Center for IHAP.com, and on my website is my phone number. So feel free to call or drop an email through my website.
And I think if you Google Dr. DeWayde Perry, that's D W A Y D E Perry P R R Y. You'll also get there. That's how I got there.
That's right.
And you offer programs not just to locals in Eugene, Oregon. You have people from all over the country who probably consult you for your services.
That's right, Dr. Hoffman. I do. I also offer virtual consultations, so that's another way I can help patients.
Well, great. I mean, I really appreciate your integration of your own personal experience with exercise and your own professional training in that field with a medical practice. I think, and I wish more and more doctors would incorporate that. You certainly are a role model for the physician of the future.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with your listeners, too.
It's my pleasure. Dr. DeWayde Perry is our guest. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.